place that's not even on the market yet. I know this seems like an outrageous amount of money, but when the price tag is this high, another $100,000 or so is like caulk in a leaky tub. It's there to patch things together. We had come so far, and I knew we could get to the finish line. That's when I asked the buyer and seller to split the difference. Meet halfway is probably the nicest sounding way of getting a deal done in the history of the negotiation world. Both sides feel good, and both sides feel like the other side gave an equal share. They both agreed to come up and down so that the selling price was $4.5 million. Deal! The sellers could move to the house they bought in Connecticut, and Gemma would have her screening slash band slash hamster room. Footnote. She had adopted 5 hamsters over the course of our 4-year sales odyssey. End footnote. And best of all, Amelia and I could head to Greece and get married without worrying about any of this. Ha! Negotiating tactics that can keep your ball in play. If it seems like you are miles away from an agreement, don't be afraid. There are many ways to bridge the gap and find a mutually agreeable situation. Always make a counteroffer. You can't get anywhere without a counter. Remind clients there's always a cost for time. Time is expensive. You can't predict the market. You can't assume there is always a better offer. Can the parties involved split the difference? Can you, as a salesperson, offer an additional incentive? Can you lower your commission? Pay for a cost associated with the deal yourself? Remember, $10 is better than no dollars. Play the fears. Talk about the wall, not buying and not selling. Remind the buyer of the risks. Not buying could mean a missed opportunity to buy something they love, get a good price, or purchase something they've been seeking for a long time. If you deal with sellers, remind them that going to the market is always risky. Emphasize to both parties that the deal can be made right now. Keep the conversation moving. To push a ball back into the wind, keep the dialogue moving, even if your client is reluctant to keep talking. Listen carefully and craft an appropriate response to your client's concerns. Spread the win around. What else can be thrown into the deal to make everyone feel like they are in a winning situation? Example, I once got 2 parties who were at odds to agree to a deal when the seller threw in the dining room set for free. The sellers were excited for their new adventure in Connecticut, and Gemma was working on her co-op board package. The apartment on 12th Street happened to be in a co-op, which meant that she had to be approved by a group of owners, called the board, before the deal could be official and she could close. The co-op board package is a super invasive rite of passage for most people who buy an apartment in New York City. Buyers must share their entire financial history, salary, tax returns, etc., with the other owners in the building. If you defaulted on a payment on your Victoria's Secret credit card when you were 23, they'll know about it, and if you're lucky enough to get approved, you'll share that shame with them every time you ride the elevator. There's evidence you're mean or insane, you have a yappy dog, or you play the tuba as your hobby. They don't like your face. It's Thursday. All reasons you can be denied by a New York City co-op board. But welcome to New York. The co-op board is all powerful. They can deny you for any reason they want. I got on a plane for Greece knowing Gemma was carefully putting her board package together. All was right in the world. After 4 years of working with Gemma, I was getting married as a happy salesman. July 1st, 2016. Arrive in Corfu, Greece. And now back to my big fat Greek wedding. We had rented the biggest villa in Corfu for 2 weeks, and we were planning to go crazy having fun and celebrating our love. It's Greece! We had a big welcoming party, and all of our family and friends were there. Life was great. But then, my seller of the 12th Street loft left a message saying there was a problem. Normally, one of my amazing team members would have taken care of the board package as well as any issues that came up, but this client insisted that I handle everything personally. I had promised Amelia I wouldn't work during our wedding, even though I was kind of already working since I had brought along a film crew. But I hadn't gotten this far in my career by not returning phone calls. Deals die every day, and I fix them. I called my seller. The problem? Since Gemma's parents were gifting the funds for the purchase, and since she was young and technically unemployed, the co-op wanted all her parents' financial information too, and her parents didn't want to provide it. To the co-op board, the refusal to provide this information was like a red flag about the size of a midtown skyscraper. I spent the next couple of days covertly making calls. Amelia would kill me. And going back and forth with the buyer and seller, trying to shepherd them through this process. In the meantime, wedding drama abounds. The church is double booked. The flowers are trapped in Holland. I'm trying to make sure we have the best wedding ever, but in the back of my mind is this relentless chatter about financial information and co-op board interviews. I try to make myself feel better by reminding myself that I'm attentive and empathetic, and this is just a bumpy ride to a closing, with a $270,000 commission on the line. Sirhan's secret number 20. One of the reasons you can't live or die by one sale is because you have a life. I will do absolutely everything in my power to close a deal, but I learned at my wedding that I did not want to be ironing out deals while my children were being born or on my deathbed. July 7th, 2016, 4:48 p.m., 12 minutes until my wedding. It turns out I was not receiving a call about a wedding-related disaster. It was just a real estate disaster. Damn it. Hi, Ryan. It's Gemma. So the board admitted me, but we just aren't comfortable with a building that wants so much financial information. So we don't want to buy it anymore. We're asking for our money back. Thanks. And sorry. In that split second, my big commission vanished. I also feared my seller would kill me. Instead of going on the market a month before my wedding, I had encouraged my seller to take this seamless off-market transaction. Going back to market in the dead of summer would be a disaster. This means I needed to do damage control quickly. The seller needs to know about this ASAP since they are ready to move and this ugly development will ruin their plans. I call my seller to relay the news that their buyer is pulling out. I'm about to get married in a few minutes, but I'll be back in the city next week and you have my word that I'll find you a new buyer. That wasn't good enough. There was yelling. A lot of it. I tried to explain that the co-op board scared the buyers, and that even though I did everything I could to keep the deal alive, I couldn't control the buyer's feelings. But that wasn't enough. In a dying deal, the salesperson always takes the blame. They didn't want to work with me anymore. Click. Ugh. While it's frustrating that the deal died, and that it died during my wedding, I learned an incredibly important lesson. I felt awful during one of the best weeks of my life. I was supposed to feel incredible. I let my clients control my emotions because I felt indebted to them. When someone hires me to sell their home or represent them in a purchase, it's like life or death for me. I care about the trust these people have invested in me. I felt like I failed them. I worried that no one would want to sell with me again. I started to doubt my own abilities. I think every salesperson has taken a walk down this very dark path at some point. And from that moment on, I decided that dying deals were not going to kill me. I also reminded myself that the loft on 12th Street was not my only ball. When I got back from my wedding, there were still many other balls in play. I vowed at that moment to learn something from every single ball that fell flat. Instead of failing hard, I needed to fail smart. This would help me grow as a salesperson and help me prevent other balls from falling in the future. If you're thinking, oh my God, what is wrong with you? You were about to get married to a beautiful woman on a Greek island. Please know that when I got on my pirate ship, I left all my problems behind. It was an awesome wedding and a day I will never forget for all the right reasons. 6 reasons balls fall and kill your deal. Everyone drops a ball or has a deal die, and it sucks. And if you haven't, you're the first person in the known universe. The deal with Gemma was one of hundreds that I've lost during a 10-year career. And it wasn't even the biggest. I once lost a deal with a $1.2 million commission. Yeah, ouch. What I've learned is that balls fall for a lot of different reasons. But if you understand the most common deal killers, you're more likely to be able to keep your balls in the air. Don't get me wrong, losing a sale is no fun, especially when you've done everything in your power to keep it going. Sometimes I feel like an ER doctor giving CPR to a dead guy. I just want to be able to tell the family I did absolutely everything I could to save him. There really is a bright side to deals dying, though. From failure comes success. I know that sounds like bullshit, but I swear it's true. Even when you've lost money, you've gained experience. Remember 99 John? My first big building where I learned so much? I was fired from that project. At the time, I thought it was the worst day of my life. But had I not been fired, I wouldn't be where I am today. I know that doesn't help when you're trying to pay your mortgage or pay back your student loan, but there will come a time in a sale when you think, wait a minute, this is familiar. Oh, wow, I know exactly what to do. Any sale that doesn't work out is preparing you to close future sales that haven't even happened yet. Let me share with you what I've learned are the 6 reasons balls crash and die, so you can gain knowledge without experiencing my pain and suffering and keep all your balls in the air. Yeah, you're welcome. Number 1, failure to communicate. Lack of communication is the leading cause of death in sales, and any relationship, really. I keep sellers aware of what I'm doing to sell their apartment, holding open houses, advertising and marketing efforts, incoming offers, etc. When I'm trying to sell something to someone, I'm in touch every week about apartments that have just gone on the market and ones that might be right for them. Keep your customers up to date on sales, promotions, and product changes. Touch base regularly so clients know you're taking care of them. If you get fired from a deal, chances are it's because of a breakdown in your communication. If you don't talk to your spouse for a week, it doesn't matter how much you love them in silence, you are going to have problems at home. And by the way, communication is free. Number 2, you're replying, not responding. Keep the communication flowing so you can get a sense of what stage of the sale your client is facing. Excitement, frustration, fear, disappointment, acceptance, happiness, or relief. Listen to your client and address any issues carefully, clearly, and quickly, but do so with care. Most salespeople reply to their clients with standard lines they use on everyone, but the best salespeople listen to their clients and respond thoughtfully. Remember, nearly anything can be bought online today, but the advantage you have as a salesperson is empathy. The internet is not empathetic. The internet can't take a client out for a drink and say, listen, I know this process is stressful, but let's talk about it. I just want you to know I hear you and I've got your back. Don't forget to put yourself in your client's shoes from time to time. Number 3, you've set unrealistic expectations. I once got fired from a deal in the Hamptons because I was completely wrong about my availability to be physically present on a property. That was my fault for setting unrealistic expectations, and I've never made that mistake again. I'm also careful about setting realistic expectations about pricing. It's so easy to say yes to people, but it causes major problems later. I've gotten comfortable with the idea of having uncomfortable conversations. I won't agree with a client that his apartment should be priced at $12 million when I think it's more like $8 million just to get a job. If I did that, I wouldn't sell the apartment, and the client would be angry, and I promise you, he would not remember that the $12 million price tag was his idea. That scenario would end with me getting fired so he could hire a more realistic and more honest broker. Make it your policy to be upfront and honest about everything. That includes potential challenges you and your customer could encounter along the way. Number four. You don't know your shit. When I was new to selling real estate, I had no confidence and zero experience. That's true. But I knew my shit. I couldn't lean on confidence and experience to get me through a showing or a sale, so I memorized absolutely everything I needed to know about my product. I could rattle off square footages, the year an apartment building was built, what the countertop was made of, the brand of the kitchen appliances, if dogs were allowed, how far the apartment was from the subway, the doorman's name, and how many minutes it would take to walk to get a cup of coffee. Once again, remember why a client is buying from you, and cough, not the internet. It's because you are a source of knowledge. You can't be in the middle of selling an engagement ring to someone when you realize, oh, sorry, you wanted platinum? Damn, this only comes in gold. My bad. Will your fiancé love gold? Know what you are talking about. Show your value as a salesperson. And it's easy. Just do the work. Memorize the info. Ready, set, go. Number five. Your approach is stale. Complacency is the real death of a salesman. Take a very long, hard look at yourself. Are you mindlessly and robotically going through the same pitch? Are you connecting with every single customer who walks in with the same tired line about how the cold weather sucks? Are you not feeling excited about going to work and potentially selling a ton of stuff? If any of that sounds familiar, you might need to shake up your approach. I understand what this feels like. Not too long ago, I felt like Bill Murray in the movie Groundhog Day. My life felt like it was the same every day. Wake up, exercise, go to an apartment, meeting, phone call, another apartment, and I felt stuck. Amelia came up with the perfect solution for my problem, and it turned out to be simple and, bonus, fun. When a big listing came in, I decided to swap it with another team member for a smaller listing. It forced me into a situation where I faced different challenges and was exercising a different skill set. I ended up having a great time, and it was just what I needed to get excited about sales again. If you're feeling stuck, consider working with a different kind of ball for a while. This will help you shake up your approach. You'll be surprised by the difference this can make. Number six, you're overly focused on the money. The day my credit card was declined at the grocery store was the worst. If someone had said to me, Ryan, the reason you aren't selling anything is because you're too focused on the money, I would have punched them. This is the last advice anyone with money problems wants to hear, especially from someone who has money. I do know that if you're going into a sale with nothing else but money on your mind, it can impact the deal. For example, instead of saving a deal by cutting commission to bridge the gap, your ego gets in the way because you're so focused on the full commission. And then the deal dies and you made zero anyway. Or you push a deal too hard because you just want to wrap it up and get paid. And then you're a car salesman and your client fires you and buys the same product with someone else. Worrying about bills, rent, the mortgage, and food is incredibly stressful, and I never want to feel that way again. It's hard, but make every attempt to shift your focus from financial issues back to the deal. Focusing on the deal and not the money can get you back on track. At the 2010 Winter Olympics, Shaun White had the gold medal in snowboarding in the bag before he even hit his final run down the halfpipe. He could have just coasted it. Instead, he crushed it. Why? Because he rode like he'd already won. Technically, he had already won, but the psychology of going into a pitch with the confidence that you've already won can produce amazing results. Ultimately, we've all been there. We've dropped balls, lost sales, and had deals fall apart. It's the worst. But I always try to remind myself that this is par for the course. If Derek Jeter struck out during a game, he wouldn't toss the bat aside and scream, "I obviously suck, I quit," and go off to live a quiet life as a peanut farmer. That would be crazy. Focusing on that one deal gone wrong, or, okay, a few hundred dropped balls, can infect your entire career and your whole life, like a cancer. Don't let it. Deals will always die, and that's okay, especially if you have multiple balls in the air. I had a big deal die last week. It sucked, but I didn't spend the day on the sofa eating Lucky Charms out of the box and watching reruns of Saved by the Bell. How is that helpful? Yesterday, I made a huge sale. I didn't put down the phone after the deal was done and say to my team, "Well, that's awesome. See you guys later. I'm going to take the afternoon off to watch Narcos on Netflix and eat nachos." I keep at it. Tend to my other balls and focus on the bigger picture. The one where I have the best month of sales ever. Sirhan's secret number 21. When I don't get a piece of business, I want to know why. Why not me? I'm awesome. The truth is, there are some factors you just can't control, and you shouldn't waste your energy obsessing over them. Move on and go for other balls. If you ever feel like quitting, please listen first. Sales is the hardest job there is. In some jobs, there's no safety net, like a regular paycheck or a boss to direct you. There's no guarantee that a big sale will actually go through. Salespeople have the most amazing highs, but the lows are painful. Sales can be exhausting, frustrating, and disappointing at times. But if you find yourself standing on the precipice, please consider the following first. Have you set the bar way too high? Lots of people fail at sales because they have insane expectations. I'm all for encouraging big goals, but make sure you're making reasonable goals. Don't think you're failing because you've raised the bar too high for yourself. Recalibrate your goals if necessary. If you're just learning to ski, you don't go down the highest mountain first because you'll probably die. You start with the bunny hill, then take on the medium hill. And when you've nailed those, you can think about hitting the black diamond. Once you've gained the skills and experience to ski down it without breaking your neck. And remember, if you're at the bottom, fine. Up is the only available direction. Remember, I'm the guy who made just over $9,000 my first year in sales only 10 years ago. Is inaction stressing you out? Remember your why. Not taking action can make you feel terrible. If you're in a sales slump, you can't wake up thinking, "Oh, I can feel it. Today's the day everything will turn around." That is very wishful thinking. The only thing that can change your situation is you. Do you love the product you're selling? Your why is like a powerful vitamin pill. It provides the extra boost of energy you need to take control and move forward. When is the last time you gave yourself a reward? You've had a bunch of deals die, you're in a slump. It may sound counterintuitive, but I think the best thing to do right now is to reward yourself. I'm not saying you should necessarily buy a luxury car, but reward yourself with something that will boost your spirits and your confidence. Buy a new suit or handbag so you feel great at your next pitch meeting. It doesn't have to be something big. A crazy purple tie catches your eye. Get it! And know you look fantastic the next time you meet with a potential client. In 2014, I had a really slow month, so I bought my first apartment. My budget was about $1.5 million, but I spent almost $4 million on a penthouse in West Soho. It was the most terrifying thing I'd ever done in my life. But it catapulted my sales for the rest of the year because it set a new wall for me. I had bought it, now I had to pay for it, or I was dead. Sirhan's secret number 22. Remember that there is always an action you can take. There's always something you can do right now to change the outcome of your career. There is always something you can do. Maybe it's focusing on different balls, changing up your pitch, or shifting your energy from the money back to the deal. Call up someone who didn't hire you and politely ask for feedback. Use that information to improve and refine your skills. Try something, anything. And in the end, where does it get you tomorrow if you quit today? Nowhere. Face your challenges head on, and chances are you'll end up somewhere really amazing. When you face your biggest failure every day. The Brooklyn house on Ocean Parkway was incredible, and the asking price was a whopping $14 million. In 2012, this was my biggest ball to date. It was the first listing I had at this price point, and I thought it would change my entire life. If I sold this, it would lead to more giant listings. I could hire more team members, move into a bigger apartment, and maybe lease a cool car. It would be a massive commission check and a huge step forward in my career. The house was in the Syrian Sephardic community in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. It was 10,000 square feet with 5 bedrooms. The dining room table was so long, you could have all of Brooklyn over for Shabbos dinner. Easily. The 3 chandeliers that sparkled above it were $300,000 apiece. The house had dome skylights with motorized shades, an elevator, and special heated sidewalks to melt any snow that dared land there. I put so much time, money, and effort into selling this house, and a year went by without getting an offer. Not a single one. For a year, I spent most of my time and energy on one very big ball. I was hyper-focused. I wasn't looking at the big picture or thinking about what would happen if that giant $14 million ball fell flat, which it did. I still love the challenge of selling something big, but that experience taught me how important it is to play with balls of all different shapes and sizes. I confront this failure every single day. I have a nostalgia wall in my office. I framed a lot of articles about myself and my business that I'm proud of. Big deals and awards we've won. But right in the middle of it all is an article that reminds me about my biggest failure ever. The headline in the New York Daily News reads, $14 million inside Brooklyn's most expensive home. The article is all about that crazy house, and at the bottom is my smug, smiling, oblivious face. I framed it and hung it in my office as a reminder that no matter how much success I have, I will always fail. But I will fail smarter. I won't spend as much energy on one ball as I did with that house in 2012. I will be relentless in my efforts to get as many balls up as possible. Now I know full well that there's likely more failure to come, because the only way to avoid failure altogether is to do nothing at all. And that's just not an option. The Sirhan way. Balls will always fall. That's okay. Sometimes there's nothing you can do, but incorporate these simple techniques into your sales practice to maximize your chances of keeping them up in the air. Negotiating tactics to help keep your ball in play. Bridge the gap, play the fears. If you're dropping a lot of balls, you need to do a self-check. Are any of the following an issue? Common reasons balls get dropped. 1. Failure to communicate. 2. You're replying, not responding. 3. You've set unrealistic expectations. 4. You don't know your shit. 5. Your approach is stale. 6. You're overly focused on the money. Just don't quit. But in case you're thinking about it, but don't, when you feel like quitting, ask yourself, are you setting reasonable expectations? Is inaction stressing you out? Remember your why. When is the last time you gave yourself a reward? Practice your craft. It's human nature, usually, to want to reply instantly when someone speaks to you. But in sales, how you respond, note I said respond, not reply, to a customer can make the difference between closing a deal or losing a customer. It takes practice to do this. It requires you to fight your natural urge to talk. If this is a problem you struggle with, here are two exercises that can help you. 1. Just seriously say nothing for 20 minutes. Stay silent. Do you have any idea how difficult this is? I mean, I've never done it myself, but I imagine it would be really hard. Joking aside, this exercise can really help you think before you speak so that you can respond to clients in a thoughtful manner. 2. Sell something silently. Try selling anything, your car, your dog, your husband, to a friend. You can only use facial expressions and hand gestures to express why this purchase should be made. It's hard. Chapter 10. Do it right now. The letters read, Heaven's Gate, in ornate gold letters. Footnote. No connection to the extraterrestrial-obsessed cult of the same name that committed mass suicide in matching Nikes. End footnote. The sign rested on top of the most imposing, elaborate, wrought iron gate. To my 13-year-old eyes, it looked like the gate loomed all the way up into the sky. I can't even imagine what my 10-year-old brother was thinking. The gate was like something out of a gothic horror movie. It was completely overgrown with vines. In the 4 years we had lived in Topsfield, Massachusetts, we had never once seen the gate open. We had never seen anyone enter or leave. My little brother and I loved to ride past the big gate on our bikes at the end of John's Lane. We'd always stop for a few minutes, making up stories about what was up there. Was it a scary old witch who hadn't left the house in decades? Did a mad scientist have a laboratory in a big mansion up there? Or maybe, as my brother and I both secretly hoped, it was Batman's house. We were riding our bikes around on a summer day when curiosity got the better of us. We wanted to finally know what was really up there. It turns out we were able to push the gate open just enough to slide ourselves through. We couldn't believe we were inside the gate. We walked up a steep, winding driveway with the most lush foliage and flowers flanking each side. About 5 minutes later, we saw something that we couldn't believe. Another gate. This one was smaller, but equally as ornate. We were getting excited. Only a truly amazing person would have a driveway and a gate like this. We were getting our hopes up. Could Batman really be our next-door neighbor? Oh my God. We passed through the second gate and continued walking up the long, curvy driveway. And in about another 5 minutes of walking, we encountered yet another gate. What? This house was obviously going to look like a castle. Would there be a moat? A suit of armor? The foliage got deeper. There were wild patches of roses that had grown like crazy. We passed a fountain that looked like something from a fairy tale. A creepy fairy tale, because it was full of weeds and the water looked green and it smelled. When we finally got to the top of the hill, we stopped. Right in front of us, where we expected the world's most marvelous house to be, was nothing. We walked closer. not really believing this 2-mile-long driveway with its rolling fields of roses and 3 gates could lead to just nothing. What we found was a massive hole filled with cement, the largest concrete slab you could imagine. It was the foundation of a house that had never been built. We were disappointed, to say the least. Why would anyone build such a crazy entrance and plant all this stuff and never build the house? We walked back down, got on our bikes, and went home to play video games. I told my dad what we had found, and after a few hours of being punished for breaking and entering, he agreed to help figure out what had happened. Why wasn't the house built? Was the owner kidnapped? Did they die just thinking about all that yard work? Was he a spy who had to flee before the house could be finished? We found our answer. It turns out that whoever owned the property was planning to build his dream mansion. He started with the gate, and he spared no expense. He spent a fortune on landscaping, flowers, bushes, and trees, and then the other gates. He shipped in gravel for the driveway from Italy and olive trees from Greece. The entrance to this house was going to send a message that the house you were about to enter was the best house ever. And what he had built was beautiful. But unfortunately, he had spent so much money on those details that there was nothing left. He ran out of money. He couldn't afford to build the actual house, and the bank eventually repossessed the property. All that money, time, and effort spent on a fence and no house to show for it. I couldn't help but wonder, what would have happened if he had built the house first? To add insult to injury, my dad told me Heaven's Gate was also the name of a 1980s movie that was infamous as being the biggest box office bomb of all time. I remember how wildly disappointed 13-year-old Ryan was by that big slab of concrete. I had been hoping to go back to school with stories about how I spent my summer drinking lemonade with my best friend Batman and hanging out in his pool. There was no way I could have known it then, but that adventure with my brother taught me 2 of the most important lessons in life. 1, there is no obstacle too big for me to climb over. And 2, do the most important things first. Those simple lessons have impacted how I've shaped my work ethic and grown my business. I've carefully prioritized what needs to happen for my business to thrive. A driveway to nowhere is just a dead-end road, but a beautiful house without a driveway is still a beautiful house. And as salespeople, we are constantly faced with obstacles. There are fences we have to leap, shimmy, climb, and fight our way over nearly every day. The last message I want to leave you with is this. Be deliberate about how you grow yourself as a brand and as a business person. Don't have analysis paralysis and overthink everything. Focus on what really matters and then take action. And also, there's no fence big enough to keep you from reaching your goals. Obstacles are just fences, and there are a million ways to climb over them. They're not walls. Walls are impenetrable. You run away from walls. Broken, afraid? That's a wall. Get as far from that as you can. Just bought something you can't afford? Shit, that's a wall. Get as far from that as you can by working harder and earning more money to afford it. I know what it feels like to think you won't make it over a fence. Sometimes, getting to the other side feels nearly impossible, and I don't think I have it in me. But eventually, I find a new way, and I realize I just had the most amazing sales week ever. I'm so glad I forced myself to keep going and that I found my way to the other side. Shooting Sell It Like Serhant and working with salespeople who sell all different kinds of products showed me that we all face our own unique obstacles. We all have our own fences to climb over. To be an incredibly successful salesperson, one who is juggling multiple balls and regularly closing, you always have to be prepared to reach, to do more, to do something different. There are countless kinds of fences of varying heights and widths, and some might be really treacherous, like those covered in barbed wire. Chances are, there are some fences that all salespeople have encountered, and those are the ones I'm going to talk about here. including my biggest fence. I'd love the chance to hear about your fences. If we work together, we can always find a way over them. Social media has made it easy for all of us to discuss this. Tweet me at Ryan Serhant or connect with me on Facebook or Instagram and tell me about your fence. There is no obstacle too big for you to get over. How can I make myself stand out? After my Sunday morning workout, I usually head to my office in Soho. It's my happy time. It's quiet and peaceful, and I spend an hour or two getting organized and prepared for the week ahead. I check out my calendar and clean out my inbox. If you haven't responded to an email I've sent you, you'll be getting an email from me on Sunday morning. Hey, why haven't you responded to my email? Nothing gets past me. Sunday is also my cheat day, so I get to eat Doritos while I work. But today is a little different. I'm meeting with my social media team to discuss a new venture. A few months ago, we decided that I should start a video blog. I realize that I'm a little late to the game when it comes to posting videos. There are 9-year-olds who have millions of subscribers to their YouTube channels dedicated to making slime. But about 11,000 apartments get sold in New York City each year. And there are about 30,000 licensed real estate agents. Most people would look at those numbers and think, wow, the odds are not good for making money as a real estate agent in New York City. Forget about it. I prefer to look at it from another angle. I only did a small percentage of those 11,000 deals last year. How do I make more deals? Why isn't everyone using me? How do I let people know I'm out here and all I want to do is sell their apartment or help them find one to buy? I'm very fortunate that I'm out there on a national scale during the 3 months of the year that Million Dollar Listing New York airs. And now I get to be in the face of America for an extra 2 months out of the year thanks to Sell It Like Serhant. But what about all those other months? Sure, I'm very active on social media. I post on Instagram. I tweet. But that's not enough. I'm not just going to sit back and hope I get a call from some person who binge-watched Million Dollar Listing while they spent a week on the sofa recovering from strep throat. A vlog is a longer form of social media that gives me a chance to have some fun. I can be super personal and show crazy moments from my life that may or may not be real estate focused. I want to give people a sense of what my weeks are like and show them how hard I work. I know I have 2 shows on Bravo, but it's not enough for me. I'm not being snobby, and believe me, I know when I'm an asshole. I'm just saying I still don't have market share. So the vlog on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/RyanSerhant, go now, is my new expansion of my brand. And if it doesn't work, it's not a big deal. No one will have been harmed during the making of my vlog. There's no good reason not to try it. One of the biggest fences I have to face as a salesperson is finding fresh ways to distinguish myself in a never-ending sea of real estate brokers. The second I think I've left this fence behind for good, it crops up again. And I have to find a new way to hurl myself over to the other side. I always want to do more today than I did yesterday. I never want to look back at my career and think, "Ugh, what if I had tried that?" You know where you'll find the most wasted potential? The cemetery. As long as I'm alive, I will do everything in my power to use every ounce of my potential and keep climbing over that fence. Do more. Offer a unique promotion. You can't wait for someone to toss a bunch of balls to you. You can't wait for business to just walk through the door. You need to give people a reason to show up. Autumn in New York is amazing. So, I decided to give out free pumpkins from my office in Tribeca. Fall is here, everyone! Rejoice! People who live in Tribeca can most definitely afford their own pumpkins. But that wasn't the point. This was just a fun way to let people know who we were and what kind of services we offer. It's not every day that you get a free pumpkin just walking down the streets of New York City. This was a simple way to make an impact. Talk to your boss and team members about what you can do. Samples? Buy one, get one free for a friend? There's always something you can offer to get people to remember you. Don't just make deals, create deals. Use your sphere of influence to find a new way to distinguish yourself. Amanda, who sold hot tubs, had children and she knew a lot of moms. And guess what? She figured out that hot tubs are awesome for families. It's like a mini pool everyone can relax in. She started talking to other parents, at school drop-off, at the playground, anywhere, about how much fun it is for the entire family to have a hot tub. Now, not only is Amanda the one who sells luxurious hot tubs, she's also the one who can find the perfect hot tub for your family. Think about who you know. Is there something unique about your sphere of influence? Perhaps you sell the best scented candles on earth, and you have lots of artists in your sphere of influence. Share with them that the delicate lavender scent of your candles promotes relaxation and therefore stimulates creativity. Think about what new connections you can make between your product and who you know. I don't have enough money to invest in my career. 10 years ago, when I put on my keeper hat, I realized that I could spend approximately $100 per paycheck to invest back into my business. So I know exactly what it feels like to feel hindered by the lack of a marketing budget. Don't focus on what people who make a lot of money are spending. Stay within your comfort zone. Say you only have $10 a week to invest in yourself. That's enough for just about 50 stamps. Get printer paper and envelopes from work or school and handwrite nice notes to prospects. Stamp and send. If you send 50 letters per week, that would be 2,600 handwritten letters per year. You are guaranteed to get calls with that much outreach. And it only costs as much as 2 Starbucks lattes. There's always a way to invest back into your career, even if you're just starting out. You just have to do it. Do more. Social media. It's free. My social media platforms have been incredibly helpful when it comes to promoting my brand and my services, and I'm proud of how my audience has grown over the years. But I am not a social media expert, and there are probably a billion articles dedicated to the best way to maximize your social media presence. Social media is essentially your public resume. So think about the image you want to project. The best thing about social media is that it's free. It costs you nothing to start posting beautiful Instagram pictures of the hand-knit organic sweaters you sell. Take advantage of the different platforms to grow your network and draw attention to the services you offer. For every 2 personal posts, post 1 photo or video for your business. People want to know what you can offer, but they want to know you too. Remember what we talked about in Chapter 3? People don't like to be sold, but they love shopping with social media friends. Perfect your F3, the follow back. I've been going to the same dentist for years. I've often thought about switching dentists because it would be much more convenient for me to go to one that's closer to my office. Time is money. But my dentist is so thoughtful with his follow back that I think he's probably going to be my dentist for life. About 6 weeks before I'm due for a cleaning, he sends a quick follow-up reminding me to schedule my appointment. And he includes jokes. I get his email, laugh at a tooth joke, and schedule my appointment. Get creative and personal with your follow back. What can you do to keep yourself in the minds of your customers? Do you sell gardening supplies? Maybe you write the best ever newsletter, sharing great tips for getting your yard ready for different seasons. Or maybe you pick up the phone every day and call each client who has a birthday on that day. That's the easiest form of follow back there is. And I'll bet you're listening and you don't do it. And P.S., follow back and newsletters are totally free. Practice, practice, practice. As salespeople, our bodies and our voices are our tools. It's easy to underestimate how important our body language and the tone of our voice are when it comes to selling. When I was working with Mariel, who sells waxing services, I noticed right away that she tended to loom over her customers. She didn't get down on their level when she spoke to them. This is awkward and makes people uncomfortable. especially when you're trying to sell services that involve them being covered in hot wax. We worked together to find a way for her to interact with people more naturally. Jen, who sold skincare products, also needed to work on her body language. She tended to assume a posture that made her appear shy and closed off. She didn't exactly exude confidence. We worked on using mannerisms that made her appear more open and friendly. Amanda, who sold hot tubs, had the same monotone voice whether she was happy, sad, or sleeping. So, we worked with a voice coach to show her that her voice had range. When you use inflections, people respond to you better and listen to you more. If you can't afford a voice coach, stand in front of a mirror. Make sure your posture and body language are strong and confident, and film yourself talking with your cell phone until it's not weird. Then show the clips to someone you trust and ask for honest feedback. And all the crazy exercises I've included throughout the book to make you a more awesome human, you should be doing those. How do I incentivize myself to reach my goals? Since my early days in the real estate business, I've always backed myself into a corner on purpose. Getting cast on Million Dollar Listing New York when I was a very new broker meant things were getting real. The show had confidence in my ability, and that was my first big shot to the head, metaphorically. I couldn't sit around in my apartment watching TV anymore unless I wanted the entire world to watch me fail on television. I had no choice. I had to figure out how to be the best broker. Backing myself into a corner has pushed me to greater heights every year since. I bought an apartment that was 4 times my budget, and the house Amelia and I are buying in Brooklyn will push me to work even harder. By the way, Mom and Dad, it will all work out fine. You don't have to worry, I swear. So, set a goal the way we talked about in Chapter 6. Tell yourself that if you hit your monthly goal, you can buy that thing you wanted. If you don't hit your goal, you can't have it. Do more. Cut out the net. Eric, the guy with the big beard on Sell It Like Sirhan, worked for a company that rented out apartments to kids just graduating from college. He spent 4 hours of his day commuting, which was bananas. I certainly understand that rent is expensive. I'll say it one more time. My credit card got declined at the grocery store. But making a deliberate choice to change your circumstances, backing yourself into a corner, can be the fire you need to get ahead. If you're living with your parents, consider moving out. If you face a long commute and you want to move closer to work, do it. If you're reluctant to fork out the money for full-time childcare because you're not earning much yet, think about what you can achieve if you have everything you really need to succeed at your disposal. I don't want to tell you how to live your life. If you love where you live, that's awesome. My point is that acknowledging what actually might be holding you back from success and dealing with it directly can have a huge impact on your career. Cut out that safety net. Plan a trip. Where have you always wanted to go? For our first wedding anniversary, Amelia and I wanted to go back to Greece. But this time, instead of renting a villa and filling it with everyone we know and bringing along a TV crew, we were going to cruise the Greek islands in our own private yacht. I also had made big plans to eat ice cream during every day of this vacation. Our anniversary is the first week of July, and I marked it on my calendar in red. I've been doing this for years, and now the trips I take are just more extravagant. Every time I see the date of my vacation, A, I get really excited, and B, I feel incentivized to push myself harder. I want to make sure I'm earning this vacation. I'm not suggesting you do something outrageous, like rent out the QE2 or charter a private jet, but someday, yes, you should. But plan something that incentivizes you. Have something on the calendar that makes you want to work harder and pushes you during those moments when it seems too hard to get to the other side of that fence. Do the important things first. When I was ready to start building a team, I decided it made sense to look at what the uber-successful real estate brokers did. What did they all have in common? I noticed something right away. They had business partners. That's what I would do. I found a partner, and we got to work. But what the work looked like to me and what the work looked like to him were different. To me, the work, especially in the early stages of growing a team, was about making sure we had the business to support a team. To him, the work was more about systems, having the internet set up and creating a good office space. I was out there making connections and chasing business while he was in the office arranging furniture. That partnership didn't work out, but it solidified a belief that I've held deep down since the day I discovered that Batman didn't live in the mansion next door. You must do the important things first. Had the Heaven's Gate guy started with the foundation instead of the big fancy gates, his outcome would have been completely different. Don't wait for perfection to become amazing. I love perfection. My job involves looking at the most beautiful homes in New York City every day. I recently redecorated my Soho office to make it an even more appealing place for people to work, and it looks great. I even added a store with lots of clothes and things with my name all over them. Always expanding the brand, you know. I also admit that I enjoy good suits, and I think I've written about my shoe-buying excursions extensively in this book. But not too long ago, I didn't even own a suit. I wore khakis and cowboy boots to showings, and I didn't let that stop me. In my first office, I shared a desk over a burger restaurant on 49th Street. Don't get me wrong, appearances matter, especially in sales. But if you're focusing on creating the perfect gate, you'll never build the perfect house. Do not wait for everything to be perfect before you commit to being an amazing salesperson. You don't need the most beautiful business card to make a sale. Do the most important things first. Building connections, creating business, finding more balls, and learning how to keep them in the air. Look at the most successful people in the world. They don't even carry business cards or wear suits, but they carry themselves like Shaun White at the Olympics. Every day is a victory lap because they've already won. Now you should think the same way, and it will eventually happen. I promise. When you are ready to build a bigger house. When most people set out to build a team, they do it backward. In my world, people plan to build the best brokerage in the world, and they set up a fancy office and hire tons of people and assume that they will enjoy success due to their size alone. The truth is, there are teams of 3 and 4 real estate brokers who do billions of dollars in business each year. Wait, that is a great business model. The amount of business you have should dictate the need for team members. You do not build the team and expect business to follow. You have to honestly answer the question, am I selling enough to warrant a team before you start building one? If you're selling millions of pencils each year, yes, you need a team. If you're still selling a dozen pencils a month, keep at it and revisit the idea of a team when you have more balls in the air. I now have a team of 60, and that is because I have built my business to a level where it can support a large team. When I started out, it was just me and Yolanda, who is now my director of operations. The two of us laid the foundation for our house. In my finder role, I made the connections and sold real estate. As keeper, I made plans for the growth of the company. Yolanda was the best doer ever. She took care of everything else. Thanks, Yolanda! Things were going well enough that we added an assistant, and eventually, our house was ready for a couple of additions. We were now able to support a couple of brokers. We built our house first, the shelter that contains the heart of the business. And sure, as everything started to grow and people began to take notice of us, we paid more attention to the landscaping, the driveway, and the gate. But we did the important things first. Finding the best team members. Energy, enthusiasm, endurance, and education. You're selling more pencils than you can personally handle in a day. Congratulations! You are ready to expand your house to fill it with team members. I'm still learning about the best ways to manage and support my team. Their success is my success. But I've learned that I get my best team members, the people who are a good match for my goals and values, by following the 4 E's. What I want in a team member might be different than what's right for you. But if you figure out what each of these areas looks like for you and make a point of hiring people who fit the bill, you'll be giving yourself a great foundation for a winning team. energy. I have a lot of energy, and so does everyone on my team. Energy is infectious, and you either get a boost from the people around you, or you get dragged down. I look for a person who is positive,